living some little men and women. They are our past. And maybe, maybe they are our future.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Inside Out with Tyra St. John. We have a very outstanding guest with us this afternoon, Dr. Steven Eisenstadt, who's the president, and he was the founder of Pacifica Graduate Institute. It's a Jungian depth psychology program. Steven, are you on?
I am.
Nice to have you here.
Well, thank you.
You've really been running a lot with your book, your new book that just came out, Dream Tending.
Indeed, I have.
Right.
Yes. It's just come out. It's really caught the imagination, I think, of a lot of folks. It's an approach to work with dreams that has a different quality to it, a different perspective.
It's so interesting. I've been reading it. I didn't get it all read, but it will certainly all be read, and I'm already using some of the exercises. It's very extremely helpful so far for me. I just started working with dreams about a month or two ago, which I should know better. But this is my start, and I'm very excited about it.
That's great.
So you tell me that it is catching on with a lot of people. I know you just did a seminar at Pacifica. You just completed one this weekend, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And can you tell us a little bit about how the book differs from other books and publications about dreams?
Yeah. Well, you know, the first thing is that everybody is fascinated with dream, and that's because I think in the morning, when our eyes open, dreams will tend to stay with us on occasion. And it's kind of a natural process, and people forever get curious, particularly about those dreams that make an impression. Often people will talk about the most difficult or the horrific or the terrifying nightmare dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Either a tidal wave is coming or somebody's chasing, or there's a dream where something is being blown up, or sometimes people are frightened of a death in a dream. So there's all kinds of images that will grab our attention. And then on the other side of that, there are beautiful images. People are in a landscape that's particularly attractive, or meeting a friend or a dear family member that either is still alive or somebody that's passed over. So dreams will captivate us from the beginning. And I think the way that this particular approach differs is that, for the most part, we have a tendency to interpret the dreams, which I think is a good idea. We try to understand what the images mean when they come in the morning. And that's always peculiar, because dreams are either funny to begin with or kind of abstract, and they don't make sense on first listening. Or on the other hand, they will have metaphor, like somebody sitting on the fence, which could represent being in the middle of two ideas or two positions or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, the traditional move that we make is to figure out, what does this dream mean? What's the meaning of the dream? And the way that this approach differs from that is that, in addition to interpreting the dream, I try to support folks in moving back into the dreamscape itself, or into the dream, the quality, the landscape of the dream, the setting, or noticing how the figures interact in the dream, or noticing what the feeling is of the dream, or what the action, how they're acting interactively with one another in the dream. And you go back into the dream as if it were a living entity, almost like watching a play that's going on in real time in the immediacy of experience. So in that way, this orientation differs quite a bit.
So we have to keep our book beside the bed, I guess, our dream book, or something where we want to kind of keep track of what our dreams are. Go ahead.
Well, I think that's the first step. I think the first step is to get really interested in dreams. It's like a good friend. To the extent that we are thinking about a friend or put any energy or intention towards that friendship, dreams are the same. They will then recur. But the trick is to catch them in the morning. And for me, personally, if I don't have a dream journal or a book or some kind of way of recording the dream, as soon as my eyes open and the outside world rushes in, those dream images just seem to disappear immediately. So for me, the first thing to do is to capture the dream and write them down so that I have some recollection.
You write every detail, or how do you handle that?
Well, I go both ways with that. I certainly try to get enough of the dream that it will create a remembrance of the dream. On other occasions, I try to capture the whole dream and write down all the detail.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if I'm not remembering the dream right at that moment in time, I'll take the dream journal or the little book by my side of the bed and take it to another room, so the kitchen or the living room, and often that'll support me in remembering the dream in the hours to come.
Right. I want to find out how you ever got started in dreams before we go on, but I also want to give our listeners a little background on you,
mm-hmm.
Which is that you are a PhD. It's Dr. Steven Eisenstadt, and you went to Fielding Institute and University of California and also University of California at L.A. You went to Santa Barbara and L.A., and that you have been professor of psychology and mythological studies at Pacifica, and you actually founded, I think I'm right, Pacifica itself. You were the founding president, which is now about 30 years old. Is that correct?
Yes, that is.
And that I didn't know that you were on the field faculty of Goddard College, is where I got my B.A.
That's going back, yes, once upon a time.
Right, way back. And then you've worked at Antioch and other universities, University of California and so forth. And you have this extensive background in dreams and in psychology, but it kind of came around, it was like your psyche taught you rather than you're bringing your psyche into dream tending.
Well, I will. I think that is just stated beautifully, how you just framed that. Like many people, you know, we're kids and going to public school, and I was noticing that my imagination was active and engaged. And I was talking with other kids, and, you know, certain kids will continue with that kind of child play, and then others go in different directions. And I was probably going in another direction, frankly. I was starting to move into the sciences, and, you know, at around third grade or so, we start getting trained into a different kind of academic rigor, even in elementary school or primary school. But then something curious happened, and I'll never forget. I was living in California, and I was at a beach with my parents. We lived in the San Fernando Valley, which is about 50 miles away from the ocean. But we'd always take that, you know, trip every weekend over these foothills to the other side of the mountains, which seemed like a long way away when you're that young. And we'd make our way to the ocean. And it was a great beach, huge white sand beach, and big signs, food, you know. It's like being in a very highly populated beach area. But one day I went on the other side of the point that jutted out, away from where the civilized areas were, and I sat on a rock. True enough, and I think I must have been 13, 12 probably at the time, this kid walked by who seemed to me, you know, like a god. I mean, that means he was about 17. And when you're 12, a 17-year-old is, you know, quite
right.
Something. And he said to me the most extraordinary thing. He said, you know, that rocks can talk. And I just couldn't believe he said that. Because, well, there I am sitting on an extraordinary, you know, sea rock already brimming with life anyway. But the tide was out and the tide pools. But I'd always imagined that rocks could talk, right? And here's this other person verifying that or giving value to that. And I was just shocked. And I'll never forget, then, of course, the tide came in. And I had to hurry to get back around to the other side of the point where all my family was. Of course, I didn't say a word because I would have seemed strange or peculiar. But I track my work in dreams back to that moment in time because, in my mind, in the actuality of the dream, when you were actually in the dream itself, all the things and the figures and the rocks and the buildings all have a kind of living sensibility. They all seem as if they are alive. So I think the dream work that I'm doing is fully and most profoundly influenced by those early experiences, I think.
So little did you know at the time that you were mapping out your life, your career, your life teaching, your life learning, at that moment.
Little did I know. And I think not until I wrote this book, Dream Tending, did it really become obvious that so many of the early influences you know, the seed ideas really were not a result only of my psychological training and my graduate work and, you know, all the different preparations for licensure and all the lectures that I've written and the academic articles. Actually, truth be told, the most essential influence, those most essential influences were early on.
Mm-hmm.
That and sitting at the with my great-grandfather in his shoe cobbler shop. I mean, those early times seemed to be the most informing.
Your grandfather sounds like an icon of wisdom. a very wonderful man who cared a great deal about people and had a vested interest in friends. Just having friends, that was of great value to him.
Yes, and I actually start the book Dream Tending with a story about him, because then I was 4 or 5 years old, and my parents would take us into Pasadena in California, and I would sit in their shop, and it was a shoe shop. I mean, mm-hmm. shoe repair shop. And he was from, you know, Russia, from the old country, so mm-hmm. to speak. And my parents, you know, they were from the Depression, or grew up through the Depression and World War II, and really didn't give a lot of value to what was going on in that shoe shop. They were doing all the right things, trying to raise us and, you know, they were the greatest generation, trying to move away from the old country into this new phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
Called America. But there was something always extraordinary in that, not only the smell of the shoe leather and, you know, the different polishes and so on, but I noticed at 4 or 5 that so many people would come into the shop, they would leave their shoes, but they would never pick them back up. They would come and they would sit and talk with this man, my great-grandfather. And that's what the idea was to sit and have a conversation. And I'll never forget sitting on his lap. Only later on, when I was in my early 20s, and actually through a dream, as it turns out, which I write about, a voice came through a dream, which does happen for many, many people, that sometimes we'll experience dreams and images and the figures and landscapes. Other times, people will experience simply a mood or a feeling or a voice. And in this instance, it was a voice, and I didn't know to who it belonged, and I also didn't know exactly what it meant. It all seemed very peculiar to me at the time. But the voice said, you know, I've written this book. Now it's time for you to go find it. Well, you know, you hear something like that, and I didn't know if I was, A, losing my mind, or, B, if there was something quite extraordinary happened. So I thought it was probably a little of both, actually.
When was that?
That was, when I was 22. So, yeah, a long time ago. And I then took it seriously, and I contacted my great aunt, his sister, and I actually made a journey to her home. And she says to me, I mean, it's right out of the movies, right? You couldn't cast this better. She said to me, you know, Stephen, I've been waiting for the person that would come to get this. And she hands me a book. And sure enough, it's a book about his life and his work, all written in, for me at that point, was hieroglyphics. It was all written in Yiddish, which I didn't read nor understand. So she handed me the book, and I sent it to a woman in New York, in the Bronx, actually, in the Yiddish community there, and had it translated. And she would translate about 4 or 5 pages a week, and I get these installments on an old typewriter. I get these installments every week, and I was reading the book and his work, and then finally discovering, you know, so much of what I was thinking about, and so much of what I valued and who I was and how I was thinking about dream and how I was imagining psychology and all of that was really originating from that early, early thinking. So, yeah, he was quite an extraordinary man for me.
Was that before you actually went into psychology? Was it UCLA or wherever you were?
Yeah, at that point I was at UCLA, and it was actually during my time at UCLA, and I was in, I'll never forget, a workshop in Santa Cruz, at the University of California in Santa Cruz, a 5-day workshop, and it was in the middle of that workshop that dream occurred, and I think it was the influence of the workshop that gave me probably enough support to go ahead and take it all seriously, and then went ahead and discovered the book.
And then it was after that that you changed from the more sciences, from the biological sciences into psychology? Was that sort of the beginning or the end of the turning point?
It was, actually. That's another story. Yeah, because I grew up in the family that I did, I was absolutely destined to become either a doctor. And if I were to fail to be a doctor, I would then, of course, be a lawyer, a doctor or a lawyer. Right? Mm-hmm. Either way it goes. Mm-hmm. And I actually started the pre-med curriculum at UCLA, only to discover that it was really different than who I was. I remember there was a person in the laboratory, you know, after, that was connected to the chemistry class and to the zoology class, and he said to me, you know, maybe this isn't exactly your direction, and suggested that I go to the other side of campus, which I did, only to discover a whole other world at UCLA, the world of the humanities and world of theater arts and mm-hmm. sociology and, you know, liberal arts. And that's where everything really did start to change.
So amazing. It was like a self-discovery period for you, it seems, during that whole thing after you got the book, and then you changed into psychology, and then you began to, you started out with discovering Freud, I guess, not discovering, but beginning to study Freud, and actually his dream therapy, or dream theories.
Yes, you know, it's what people have said over the ages, that sometimes it's easier to understand the book when you read it from the end of the book backwards. And, you know, at the time, of course, I was just caught in the whole thing and just following something that was not truly known, as we all do. I think we follow a kind of curiosity when we're given the opportunity.
Well, you've been teaching about dreams for a long time. How long?
Oh, I think 35 years or so.
35 years. Mm-hmm. And then somehow you got started, started working with James Hillman and with other psychologists. It's an interesting thing about your life, just observing it, that there was first your grandfather. Was it your great-grandfather or your grandfather?
Yeah, great-grandfather.
Your great-grandfather. And then you had this nice older gentleman who kind of gently steered you into your real self, which was psychology rather than necessarily biology or science. And then you've met others that have just been brought you along like angels or something in your life. And you, at the same time, were just ready for it and began to flower with, I guess, the founding of Pacifica.
Well, I think
somewhere along the way.
Yeah, I think so. I think there is, in Big Sur, California, along the coast, there's a place called Esalen Institute. Mm-hmm. And it was a place where people internationally would come, and Gregory Bateson and Joseph Campbell and just, you know, the who's who of people that were on the edge thinking philosophically, psychologically. Really, there's a lot of intellectual as well as experiential dialogue and conversation. And I found my way up there out of UCLA, and I met a man named Joseph Campbell, who's a mythologist, and he became quite influential. And he, I think, was the first person, as you're describing, that also started to shape and push my direction, because first he reminded me of my great-grandfather, mm-hmm. and second, he was so extraordinary in the stories that he told, and these amazing presentations of image through slides. And then he also was involved with Jungian psychology, and along with mythological studies, and he was very interested in dream. And so we met, and then developed a friendship, and somewhat collegial relationship, and he would then come to Santa Barbara twice a year after he retired from Sarah Lawrence University. Twice a year he would be here in Santa Barbara before he became more public and knowable through a Bill Moyers interview series. It really made a difference to me, actually. I think that was an early influence, and he was, as you say, like an angel or a muse or some kind of guide from someplace else, and supported my work.
Mm-hmm. And was that where you also met James Hillman?
That's interesting. I met James Hillman through a conversation with Joseph Campbell, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at Esalen. I mean, you know, I must have been, you know, really early 20s and didn't have enough money, of course, to pay the conference fees or anything. But they had this deal where you could, if you were young, you could bring a sleeping bag, and they designate three or four rooms with sleeping for people that have sleeping bags, and you could sleep there and then participate in their conferences, intern for washing dishes and working in the garden and all these other things.
Right.
So, well, that was just perfect, you know, right up my alley. So I did that, and I met a guy by the name of Rick Tarnas, who's now quite extraordinary in his own right and has written cosmos and psyche and the history of Western civilization. He's written Passions of the Mind, so he's written a lot of things. And but he said to me, you know, Steve, the way you're talking and how you're approaching dream, there's this guy named James Hillman that you really ought to think about. And he handed me the book that James Hillman wrote called Revisioning Psychology, which was exactly that, a reimagining of psychology from the inside out and really working with dreams as kind of alive, living, animated phenomena,
right.
Just the same way I do with dream tending.
Mm-hmm.
I read the book, stayed up all night, and understood as much as I possibly could. It's kind of complex. And then, as it turns out, fate again, you know, intervened, and he was giving a seminar at the Wright Institute in the Bay Area, and I just left Big Sur and went to the seminar and started to engage with James, and we've been colleagues ever since as well. And both of those people, James Hillman and Joseph Campbell, were really foundational in relation to the evolution of Pacifica Graduate Institute.
Right. I know that the library, the archives of Joseph Campbell are located at Pacifica. In fact, I worked under one of the first people who worked with Joseph Campbell at Pacifica on my creativity theme at that point. It all of it is groundbreaking, I think, in the United States. It probably has been done in other Jungian institutes and things like that, but for a university, I think it was groundbreaking. Am I right? In terms of the library and the exhibitions and the archival information that's available to people at Pacifica. Am I correct?
Yes, I think so. I think we've been very fortunate, you know, very blessed. And I think the archives now, which is under the umbrella of Opus here located at Pacifica, include the archives and library of Joseph Campbell and now James Hillman and now Robert Johnson and Maria Gimbutas and Marion Woodman, and the list goes on and on and on.
Mm.
Yeah, and I think as the institution, as a graduate school, you know, evolves 32 years now and gains a kind of reputation and high regard, just so many of these archival collections of these extraordinary people find their way into, and it does create a certain kind of uniqueness, and it is an extraordinary resource, because for every manuscript that many of these people have written, for example, James Hillman, for each of the books that he's published, there are four or five unfinished manuscripts left for others to pick up on and to move forward, so it's quite an opportunity. And in fact, the Joseph Campbell archives and collection as well, it's, you know, just if you, for a person that enjoys his work or really has followed his thinking, to sit in the archives and move through those texts, it's quite an experience.
I just ordered Richard Tarnas's book this morning, Psyche and, what is it?
Psyche and Cosmos.
And Cosmos, uh-huh, which I understand is quite profound, and I'm looking forward to reading that. But Pacifica itself is a remarkable institution. It is, I thought I had the 30-year history that Dorinda Carr told me about. And for some reason, I think it wasn't attached, so I don't have that with me today. But it has had a profound history, and it's such a beautiful place. It's a lovely, lovely, it sort of feels like the school is spiritual inside out. Inside and out, and because of the beauty of the grounds and the thoughts and thought-provoking seminars that are held there. So I congratulate you for the work that you've done and the people that you've gathered around you, and I hope that people here in Lake County, those who are getting ready to think about college, will think about Pacifica and look it up online, because it's, you can see the pictures, you can see it in the faces, and you can see it in the landscape.
Well, thank you. Very, very kind of you.
That 30-year history, sometime I would like to get. I think I was supposed to get it, but somehow it didn't translate here. So I want to tell our listeners that we are talking today to Stephen Eisenstadt, who is the founding president and still the president of Pacifica Graduate Institute in Santa Barbara and Carpinteria. Carpinteria is a tiny little town. I guess it's tiny, seems to me. It's way out in the country, and it's south of Santa Barbara, about 20 miles. And just a beautiful, stunning area in terms of the growth and the foliage there. And another thing that I really like about Pacifica is that the food, for the most part, that is served on the Pacifica campus is organic and grown there. and that the way of life is contemplative, much fun, and a wonderful bookstore that's available. But you are listening to this interview with Stephen Eisenstadt, who's been kind of all over the place recently, in demand for talking about his book called Dream Tending. And he kind of tells us what to do about our dreams. And also, I wanted to ask you, Stephen, if I could, about how one can invoke dreams or invoke the memory of dreams. If, you know, people say, well, I don't dream at all. and we're supposed to dream quite a few dreams a night, I think. So how can we invoke dreaming when we want to start on a dream path of understanding ourselves better?
Well, interesting that you use the word dream path, because we were just talking about Joseph Campbell, the mythologist, and he talks about different paths, different yogic paths. You know, sometimes people use the body, hatha yoga. There's different disciplines or different practices. And one of those paths happens to be dream. So it can become a life practice, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And to start that life practice, you're quite right, requires a way of remembering dream, or what they call in the business dream recall, right? And the way to remember dreams, if that's difficult, and it is for many people, you know, our eyes close and dreams come awake, and then our eyes open, but the dreams seem to just fly right out, you know, as soon as the world comes in. So there are three or four ways that I've discovered. I mean, there's literally dozens upon dozens of ways that people recommend, but the top three or four that I found most effective all through the years. But number one is to get interested. And simply by listening to a program like this, or to pick up a book like Dream Tending or any other book on dreams, you know, you get interested in dreams. And as a person brings their interest to dreams, dreams in turn will befriend the person, and they'll become more familiar, more remembered. So that's the first thing, just to capture or to somehow stimulate curiosity and interest. The second is to say before you go to sleep at night, these words: tonight I'm going to remember my dreams. Three times. Tonight I'm going to remember my dreams. And then in the morning, here's the key part, before you wake up and allow the world to rush in, you take that moment of time that we all know about, that moment where we're between half awake and half asleep, and we just hang out there, just spend some time there, and allow the images to come forward and be remembered. And of course, that requires having a dream journal or a pad of paper and pen or pencil next to the bedside. That in and of itself will set the intention before going to sleep. And in the morning, then you can jot down things. Now, another way to remember dreams is to have a conversation in that same journal. And you write to yourself, you write to the dreaming psyche, let's say, dear the place inside of us that dreams originate, you know, dear dreaming psyche, or whatever we call that place, dear dreams, I am interested in hearing more about you. I'm interested in your being remembered. I'm interested in what you have to say to me. I'm interested in, you know, the information that you're going to share. And you write to the dreams that way. And then in turn, you take the other side of the dialogue and allow that dreaming place to write you back and talk to you. You know, something like, it might say, you know, you never know what's going to happen. But you just write spontaneously. You know, now you're listening. And I've been around for so long, you've never listened before, and now you're listening. And you try not to get caught in guilt, you know, how we all do. You just mm-hmm. simply say, hey, I may not have been interested before, but I'm here now, you mm-hmm. know, mm-hmm. and I'm interested.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the second way. And then the third way that's really, I think, probably the direct route, is that you go back, a person can go back, each of us can go back to the last dream that we remembered, and work with that dream in whatever way that you can. In the book, Dream Tending, I have a whole number of exercises that are very helpful. And you just simply choose any one of those exercises or anything that comes to mind to talk about the dream, make it out loud, write about it, think it through, tell it to somebody else. And that in and of itself, more times than not, will increase dream recall, or allow us to remember dreams more easily.
And what about when one starts writing, and I'm not sure if it's the dream or the imaginal self, or if they're the same, sort of takes over and begins to help me understand what the dream was about and how what the allegory is in my life or the metaphor or whatever. And I get a lot of insights, but I think, well, is that my imagination or is that truly the dream? Mm-hmm. Do you understand?
I do.
And I don't know whether I should be cautious or, it's very insightful. I feel like I'm more whole than I was a couple of months ago, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. And so is that kosher in terms of dream understanding to allow the intuitive to just write?
Well, there's a lot of discussion about that, of course. And what it's called in the field in Jungian psychology is active imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And those words kind of tell the story. You allow the imagination to become active, and you actually allow the spontaneity of your intuition or your imagination to come forward and be written. And I think people do that all the time. People that are writing or painting, people that are authoring poetry. Children do that all the time when they're in imaginal play. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a spontaneous process, actually, of the human condition where we just allow our imaginations to go. And the idea is, and the question you're asking, is that different or similar than when a dream comes? Because it has a kind of life of its own, and it has a kind of a story to tell. And I think, for me, both are valuable.